drug problems are quite a nimbus in our day and time. Let me be sure I got this on. They're quite a nimbus in our day and time.
And people all over are significantly affected by alcohol and drugs and abuse. And yet, many times we are ill-equipped to know, what do I do? And when we're faced with this, usually it comes either we've inherited it from a family member, or we stumble into it because someone in the family introduces this secret life of addiction. And we often don't know what to do. And people come to us, and even in service settings or church settings, and they ask, what do I do? I want to deal with this problem. Or my son or my daughter has this problem. We want to deal with it. Or husband or someone else in the family. What do we do? And often the answer is, you need to read your Bible more and pray. And I want to suggest to you that while those are very important things to do, we need to dig a little deeper in this process. What do I read? And what do we include in prayer? And is there more involved in overcoming this stronghold of Satan than just reading our Bible and praying? And I want to suggest to you tonight the answer to that's yes. There's a lot more to it. And we don't want to minimize that. But alcohol, in this lesson we're going to talk about, we talked about illegal drugs last night, and introduce the concepts of addiction. We're going to cover some of that turf again in this particular lesson. But when we talk about forms of alcohol, we're talking about beer and liquor, wine, mouthwash. I've had mouthwash addicts. They smell minty fresh, and they're plastered. NyQuil, vanilla extract. Now, you got to be really craving alcohol to drink a bottle of vanilla extract, but it's like 90 proof. And other forms of alcohol, they can be abused, and people do abuse those. Essentially, alcohol depresses the central nervous system, so it's a depressant. And it is not uncommon to find people that are drunk with alcohol that get very suicidal because alcohol puts you into a depressed mood. Alcohol also is an amplifier. And that is, whatever the person is feeling, it gets amplified. And we've seen that acted out. If a person is a lover, amorous, you put some alcohol in them, and they're going to be a real lover. You know, just give me a kiss, baby, you know. See a person who's a fighter, someone who's very angry, and we get that person drunk, and they just want to fight. Whatever the mood is that is there for the individual that they are suppressing when they are sober will be released when they are drunk, more than likely. You have the quiet drunks that'll sit in the corner and just drink themselves till they pass out. And this is the one who is has to really work in social settings. So there are a variety of different things that respond, but essentially alcohol, when it depresses the central nervous system, it is an amplifier of whatever mood or thought is there. We know that it loosens the tongue as well. When alcohol works on an individual, it puts the frontal lobe of the brain to sleep to the degree of the alcohol. Now, your frontal lobe is where your conscience is. That's the center, that's your Jiminy Cricket, where we decide what's right and what's wrong and what we should say and do and what we shouldn't say and do and what the right thing to do in different settings is. And so it puts that frontal lobe to sleep. That means that a person who is drunk is operating without their regulator on. And so they're apt to say anything. They're apt to pick fusses or make crazy comments because that frontal lobe has been put to sleep. So alcohol does that in a person's body. The Bible has a lot to say about alcohol, by the way. In 1 Peter, the 4th chapter, verse 1 through 4, here Peter lists for us, he says, "Since, therefore, Christ has suffered in the flesh, arm yourself also with the same purpose, because he who has suffered in the flesh has ceased from sin. He's telling you there about Christ and that we need to be armed in Christ. And then he tells us, he's talking to people who used to live a certain lifestyle, and then he says, so as to live the rest of the time in the flesh, no longer for the lust of men, but for the will of God. In this, he talks about the transition that takes place when we become a child of God. We do not live for our own will, but instead we live for the will of God. And then he says this, and this is what I want to camp on for a moment. For the time already past is sufficient for you to have carried out the desire of the Gentiles. Now I want you to notice that he's comparing Christians with heathens. And he says the time past is already sufficient. It's enough. Whatever you did before you became a Christian, that's enough of that. Knock it off. Don't go back there. Well, what is this stuff? Keep reading. Having pursued a course of sensuality, that's basically passion, lust, drunkenness, carousing, drinking parties, and abominable idolatries. Now, I want to stop just a minute there and look at some words. Because in this passage, if nowhere else, Paul lists three categories, three stages of alcohol problems. He talks about drunkenness, that's falling down drunk. Carousing, that's just kind of getting a buzz. And the drinking parties, that's the people that go around, and that's your social drinkers, if you would. This is the person that if it's a drinking party, they maybe have a bottle or a can, and they go around most of the night with just have one. That's the ones that nurse the bottle. But in this, he's talking about all three categories, and he puts it in the category of idolatry and sensuality. Those are the companions we talked about last night that will travel with alcohol. And here he condemns that, and he says that your time that you used to do that, that's more than enough. And then he says how the world responds to this. They think we're crazy. In all this, they are surprised that you do not run with them to the same excess of dissipation, or riot, some translations say, and they malign you. Now the world surprised, it's like, well, why don't you have one with me? Why don't you have a beer with me? You know, well, what are you drinking tonight? And when you say, well, I don't drink, they want to know, well, are you an alcoholic in recovery? And when you say, well, no, I'm a Christian. And they look at you real funny. And especially if they have been associated with some group that practices social drinking or has their beer gardens down the street. And they look at us funny because we, as Christians, are teetotalers. Well, and what do? They make fun of you. They malign you. Young people, when you're out with your friends and your friends decide to get introduced to alcohol, they will also do that with you. And they'll make fun of you, and they'll chide you, and they'll tease you. As a matter of fact, that's how most young folks get into drinking, is because they're trying to impress their friends. Or they don't want to feel left out. So they're just going along with what their friends are doing. And as we talked about last night, a person doesn't know if they are addicted until they have that first introduction of a drug or alcohol into their system. When that happens, it's like you flip a light switch on that doesn't turn off. And that happens with a large part of the population, but not all. That's why there are some who can basically put it down and quit, and others can't put it down and quit. Because some have that propensity toward, a genetic propensity toward the addiction. And others simply go along and it's a learned response. Two different responses there. Now, 1 Peter 4 and verse 1 through 4, we've defined these terms here. As we said yesterday, these PowerPoints are, if you want to request a copy, the good brethren here will see that you get a copy. But I want you to note that all three levels of this consumption of alcohol, all three are condemned. Now, in terms that I would use, in a clinical setting, we would have users, abusers, and people who are dependent upon it. Okay? User, abuser, and dependent people. In this lesson, I'm going to bunch all those together and talk about this. In the criteria we looked at just briefly last night, and it's the same criteria for all of the chemical addictions, we have increased or decreased tolerance. And that basically means that a person is going to they're going to need to take more of the same thing to get the same result. So one, you may start out with a couple of beers to give you a buzz, but after a while, a couple of beers doesn't do much for you, so you may end up drinking even a six-pack to catch the same buzz you used to get with two. That's increased tolerance. Your body has learned to adjust to that amount. The decreased tolerance, for those that weren't here yesterday, the decreased tolerance is that which means it takes less to get the same effect. And essentially what that does, it tells you something is wrong with your internal organs, specifically your pancreas. You're not processing alcohol like you used to, and therefore it doesn't take as much because it stays in your system longer. So that's decreased tolerance. And when you start messing up your organs, you've got some life-threatening things that are going to happen. Cirrhosis of the liver is also in that category as well. Withdrawal symptoms with alcohol. A person may wake up with a hangover the next morning. They may, as we jump down to the bottom, to blackouts. They may not know what they did the night before or the day before. And somebody may tell them, or they may say, "Why is everybody treating me so funny this morning? Did I do something?" And it's like, well, yeah, you don't remember what you did? And they literally don't. One member of the church went out on a drunken binge, and he was found at the site of a burning building. And he was arrested for arson. And actually, he's doing prison time now. He doesn't know if he set the fire or not. Somebody did, but he doesn't know if he did or not. He just knows he was there watching a building burn. But he had no defense. No defense. Withdrawal symptoms can be pretty extreme sometime, where someone goes into the DTs, the delirium tremens. And basically, that is life-threatening. And that needs hospitalization and medical supervision. The inability to control or quit means that I've tried to stop. I've tried to cut it down, but I keep going back. And I'm not able to quit. I stop and I start again. So I'm not able to sustain a recovery time. And then use over a longer period of time than intended. The person who goes in at happy hour and goes in and leaves when they're shutting down the bar at 3 or 4 in the morning. That's longer than intended for most folks. Continued use despite consequences. I've gotten arrested. I've got a DUI. I've lost my driver's license. I've done jail time. I've done all this stuff, but I'm going to keep on using. Keep on drinking. And preoccupation means that you're planning next time you're going to go and drink. Now, getting drunk doesn't mean we stay drunk all the time. There are different categories of people who drink. There are some who are binge drinkers. That is, they'll maybe hit Friday night and Saturday, and they're out here just really just plastered. But then Sunday, they ease off so they can be at work Monday. And so they allow this to pass through their system. Alcohol generally will pass through the system. It is stored in the water tissues of the water cells in your body, and it will pass out of your system relatively quickly. Unlike some of the other chemicals that are stored in the fatty tissues of your body and work as a time release. And by that, it means that up to a month after you finish using some other chemicals, that you'll get these moments where you feel like you're high or buzzed or something, and it's like, what's that? You don't get that with alcohol, but you do get it with some of the other chemicals. Depends on where they are stored in the body. Alcohol, and we're going to get to some verses in a moment, is cunning and baffling and deceitful. And as we said last night, this is a little review, but as we said last night, that generally when people use or abuse substances, whatever the substance is, that there is some underlying pain that we're trying to deal with. A sad statistic in our culture, in America today, is that one out of four females has been sexually assaulted, abused, by the time she is age 18. One out of four. That's 25%. One out of four. If we were to count through this audience of the females, one out of four, that would likely be true in this audience. Now with men, it's one out of five has been sexually abused by the time they reach 18. That's all by self-report. My guess is, and my experience is, in the counseling field, is that the amount is about the same for men and women. But the men report it less. And so I'm guessing anywhere from 20 to 25% can be documented. If we have that kind of sexual abuse, then how do we deal with the trauma that comes from that? And so many times people will do what is called self-medicating. Sometimes abuse doesn't take on the form of sexuality, but it takes on the form of verbal abuse or some kind of physical abuse. And people have the effect of trauma in their life. And we hear sometimes people saying, man, I just need a drink. I need all this to go away. And so they'll use the alcohol to self-medicate, to kind of put their brain to sleep, to catch that buzz, to chase that feeling so they don't have to feel. In other words, I want to drink to oblivion. That's an old term, drink to oblivion, but you know what oblivion is? Drinking to oblivion is from a Latin term that means to drink or to forget and be forgotten. And so when someone say they're drinking to oblivion, they want to forget and be forgotten and just kind of go on with their life. Problem is, when you wake up from the use of the alcohol, you have even worse problems often, and a lot to fix. But pain is an underlying characteristic in this that many people in treatment do not talk about until much later, even up to 6 months after they've gotten sober. The pain is so painful. Now here in recovery, what we're asking a person to do is to deal sober with what you had trouble dealing with when you were drunk. And that's your pain. But in order to get better, you need to deal with what is creating pain for you. Now, those of you who study with people that have an alcohol problem, you want to identify what is the pain in this person's life. Sometimes it's about shame and regret. Sometimes it's about one of the three R's of anger, which is regret, resentment, and retaliation. Those three R's go together with anger, and they drive anger. So sometimes what people are trying to do is to cope with or deal with that. Now, we can show many passages in the Bible on that. We're on your turf now. You can do that. And talk about what the person's pain is, what their experience is. Talk about how the Lord has forgiven us for our past. There are so many passages in the Bible, like the woman we talked about yesterday that crashed the dinner party. And Jesus says, your sins are forgiven you. Jesus will forgive that past. The past does not have to be a predictor of your future. That Jesus will, you can take that and leave it at the cross, and there it remains. Amen? That's where it is. And so we leave that at the cross, and we can walk in newness of life. Now, a lot of folks that are baptized struggle with that. How can I walk in newness of life when I've got this history that's behind me? And the reality is, we can use our history to help others who are behind us. We talked about that yesterday with telling your story. There is value in telling your story. There's a lot of shame in hiding your story, shame and guilt. So what we want to do is to share our story. Where have we been? What have we been exposed to? And And more so, what have I learned from that experience? And we can do that. We don't tell our stories from the standpoint of bragging or comparing who's got the craziest story. That's counterproductive. But we tell our stories from the standpoint of where we've been and where God has brought us, and that there's a cleansing piece in that. When we go to an AA meeting or to a recovery meeting, regardless of what style they're using, we go to those meetings, there's generally someone that will do what's called a lead. And what that means is they get up and tell their story. And others, you know, that was really powerful. You know, man, that was hard to go through. And you get support and help and understanding of that person when you understand the miles they've walked. And there's great power in telling our stories. As a matter of fact, the Apostle Paul did that, as we talked yesterday. But cravings come in here. And cravings are, someone said, it's like a strong urge that is about 10 times stronger than normal urges. In other words, it's something that says, man, I've just got to have a drink. Okay, the body's calling out for this artificial chemical. We have trained the brain, we've eroded the brain to where the brain craves that satisfaction from that drink and the feeling. The pleasure centers of the brain are calling out for, we want this thing, we want this thing. And it calls so loud that a person often will answer that call. Denial is the hallmark of addiction. And what will happen is, you will talk to someone that has a drinking problem, whatever level, and, well, I really don't have a problem. They'll deny they have a problem, and then they'll compare themselves with the worst one they can think about. I don't have a problem. I still have a job. I'm not out in the gutter. Okay. But you still have a problem. Okay. And that person out in the gutter, they've got a problem too. But people often will compare themselves with a worst case scenario in order to say, I don't have a problem. Talked to a man one time in a family session. He had invited his young children into the session to talk about the alcoholism that he didn't think they had seen. And he and his wife asked me, would you talk to our girls? Well, one was 6 years old and one was a little over four. And I asked the four-year-old, her name was Michelle, and I asked her, tell me about home life and what it's like to have your daddy. And she looked me square in the eye. You ever had someone look right square through you? This was a four-year-old. And she looked at me and she says, real daddy or drunk daddy? Now, daddy had just told me I don't drink around her. She doesn't know I drink. She knew. But it was the family secret. They didn't talk about it. So it impacts families. We'll talk about families another time. We talked last night about the cycle of tolerance, and we've mentioned that briefly here. And that is that the first time you use whatever substance it is, and tonight we're talking about alcohol, first time you use it and you catch a buzz, if that's pleasurable, you'll go do it again. If it's not fun, if it doesn't feel right, you won't do it if you're uncomfortable with it. But that's the experience here. And so we catch a buzz, we're flying kind of good, and we're feeling good, and then we... it dissipates in our system, and so we come back, and then we go out and do it again, 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 and the highs get lower, but the lows get lower. So that if we deal with someone that is in later stages of alcoholism or is a long-term user, then by the time they get to the other end of this, by the way, the white line is where you normally would be, but by the time we get to the end, the person is drinking just to try to feel normal, but they don't feel normal because they have altered their system so much that it hasn't rebounded. Over time, they'll be able to do that. We looked last night about normal brains, and I'm going to get into some new material here in a minute. But we looked at normal brains, and then we looked at the alcohol brain and compared it to the heroin brain. These are actual SPECT scans from real people that are on these particular chemicals. The alcohol brain, as you notice, looks like it's got holes in it. Those aren't holes. Those are areas of the brain that stop working because alcohol has been introduced. Alcohol shut those parts of the brain down. And you also see some shifts in color, which has to do with moods that are being reflected in the brain. So when we look at that, we see that it does affect us. Alcohol affects us body, soul, and spirit. It affects our thinking. It affects our spirit. And certainly our relationship to God for all eternity if we don't knock it off. So what does the Bible say about this? In the book of Romans, the 13th chapter, verse 14, Paul talks here about make no provision for the flesh to fulfill the lust thereof. In other words, don't plan to sin. Don't plan to indulge. Some people plan their binges. They plan to go out to the club or to where folks are drinking, and they plan to be a part of that. Wedding celebrations. They may plan that too. But Jesus said in Matthew 7, verse 16, by their fruits you shall know them. And he talks about what people do reflects what's going on inside of them and what their values are. So as people look at us, do our fruits, if we have a drink in our hand, or we're out here with a group of people, or by ourselves, then do we have alcohol introduced? If so, then by your fruits you're going to be judged. Proverbs 23 and verse 20 says, "Don't be among wine bibbers." Now, wine bibber is not a drunk; it's a wine sipper, and that gets to that other thing we talked about—the one that's just kind of nursing the drink, and. The writer of Proverbs says, don't be among them. Don't be like them. Wine is a mocker. Strong drink is a rage. And whoever is deceived thereby is not wise, the Proverb writer tells us. We're going to look at more Proverbs in just a second. But here's some passages that while they don't talk specifically to the word drunkenness, they certainly talk about drunkenness. And these are some verses that can help us understand this, that God is telling us to stay away from that which is going to alter our state of consciousness, that which is going to release our inhibitions, and we're going to be doing and saying things that we ought not to do and say, and get ourselves in trouble. Now, a favorite passage is in Proverbs 23 and verse 29 through 35. And here, he begins by asking a series of questions. In verse 29, here's the questions. Who has woe, sorrow, contentions, babbling, wounds without cause, and redness of the eyes? All right, that's several things. Five things? Something like that. Six things. All right, so who has that? Now he answers his own question. And he says, they that tarry long at the wine, they that go to seek mixed wine. Did you know the Bible talks about mixed drinks? It's right there. So here's someone that is just, they're sitting drinking their wine and they go through this a long time, whatever a long time is. And some people are mixing their drinks. They're having mixed drinks. And those are the ones that have woe and sorrow and contentions and babbling and wounds without cause and redness of the eyes. That's that answer. And then the admonition comes, look not thou upon the wine when it's red, when it gives its color in the cup, when it moves itself aright. So here's a person looking at the wine in the glass, just kind of rolling it around, thinking how smooth that is. And that looks like, that's really mellow. I think that'll taste pretty good. And so you take a little sip and all that. That's what he's talking about. He says, don't focus on it when you first see it. But now he's telling you, think through the drink. Think through the drink. Now, that's what you need to tell folks that you're trying to get into recovery. think through the drink. Don't look at it when at the beginning and say, this will be great. Think about what that's going to do to you. All right? And then he says, don't look at it when it's like that. He says, at the last, it bites like a serpent and stings like an adder. All right? Well, those are that's pretty lethal stuff. Stinging you like an adder, that could kill you. Thine eyes shall behold strange women. Thine heart shall utter perverse things. And there I would think that he's talking. Here's a person that is hallucinating. Or they may be seeing double. Or they may be seeing something that's not there. So you're seeing strange things. And he also says that you behold strange women. That's your barflies. That's the ones that hang out and pick up people. And he's talking here about women, but women do the same kind of thing. And he says that's what's going to happen. And you're seeing people that you wouldn't normally associate with. By the way, anybody that's going to a bar to find a date is not going to have a very good result. if that's where you have to go to find somebody to go out with you. And then he says, yea, thou shalt be as he that lies down in the midst of the sea, or as he that lies upon the top of a mast. All right, now lying down in the midst of the sea, here's a person who gets out of the boat and I'm going to lay on the water. Well, you're going to drown if you do that. Or here's a high-risk situation that a person climbs up to the top of a mast or part of the way up to a mast on a pole on a boat, and they're up here all drunk and weaving and all. That's high risk. You fall, you break your neck. And he says that's the kind of things people that tarry long at the wine and that use mixed drinks, that's the kind of things that they do. Then I want you to look at the progression that's happened here. And then you will say, thou hast stricken me, and I was not sick. Okay? So, all right, I should be sick, but I'm not. Or maybe we are, we're kissing the toilet bowl because we're having trouble holding it down. They beat me and I've not felt it. This is the numbness that comes, the numbing effect of the alcohol. Somebody's wailing on you and you're insensitive to it. You don't feel it until the next day when you sober up. And then it's like, man, I'm really sore. Somebody worked me over. And then look at this last part. When shall I awake? In other words, when I wake up, what am I going to do? I'll go do it again. Okay, that's the cycle of addiction, and the proverb writer describes that. That here's a person that is not intending on quitting. They've gone through high-risk situations. They have gone out and associated with people they wouldn't normally associate with. They've tried to pick up people. And they are out here just in this wild, crazy, alcoholic world. And he's telling you, you need to think through this drink. That's where it's going to take you. Is that where you want to go as you look on it in the glass? And he says, think about it. Think through the drink. Okay, that's what we tell people all the time in recovery circles. I've just said all of these things in that. All right, in Leviticus 10, verse 9 and 10, we have a passage, it's to the priests. But if I understand it, we in God's church, we're priests today, aren't we? Aren't we a royal priesthood? Yeah. So we're priests today. So this kind of has something parallel somewhere. So he says to the priest, do not drink wine or strong drink. That's two categories. Do not drink wine or strong drink, lest you die. So there was a death penalty for these priests if they were to drink these things. That you put a difference between the holy and the unholy, and the clean and the unclean. Now look what he's saying here. While he's talking to the priest, he says the holy people of God need to be distinct from the people that are not the holy people of God. In the New Testament, that would say God's children need to be distinct from the world. We need to be different. We don't do the same things the world does. There's a line of demarcation. Why? because we've been cut out for a holy purpose to serve God in His temple, the church. Is that parallel, sort of, kind of? All right. Now, Paul emphatically asked this question, what? Know ye not that your body is a temple of the Holy Spirit that's in you, which you have of God, and you're not your own? You are bought with a price, therefore glorify God in your body and in your spirit, which are His. So, he's asking very clearly, do you not recognize that your body is set apart now, as we talked about yesterday, it's set apart for the service of God, and that's what we need to be doing, is glorifying God. Be not deceived. Evil companions corrupt good morals. 1 Corinthians 15. Now, if we're hanging out with the wrong kind of people, with people that are drinking in this lesson, then it's not going to be very long before we're going to be doing that too. In recovering circles, what you will hear at the meetings all the time is, if you go, Brother Barber here, if you go to the barber shop long enough, you're going to get a haircut. You go hang out at the barber shop, sooner or later you'll be in the chair. All right? That's the same kind of thing. You hang out with folks that are living this lifestyle, and sooner or later, you're going to do what they're doing. Evil companions corrupt good morals. Now notice that doesn't say evil companions may corrupt your good morals. He says this is kind of a statement of fact, isn't it? You hang out with the wrong people, you're associated with the wrong group, and you're going to get caught up in what that group's doing. Paul, in the book of Romans, says, the night is far spent, the day's at hand. Let us therefore cast off the works of darkness and put on the armor of light. Let us walk honestly as in the day. Here's what you're not, that's what you're supposed to do. Here's what you're not supposed to do. Not in rioting. Boy, we could use that today, couldn't we? Not in rioting and drunkenness. Not in chamberings and wantonness. Not in strife and envy. Right, that's what you're not supposed to do. What are we not doing? We're not out here getting involved in fights and all that kind of thing. Wildness. Not in drunkenness and chamberings, that would have to do also with drinking parties, or wantonness, that's sexual stuff, not in strife and envy, that's getting in arguments with people. So he says, don't do that. The child of God stays away from that. Okay. When someone comes into the church, we need to emphasize that God has made some lines of demarcation here. And now that you're a Christian, there's some things that you don't do. Being a Christian means you make some sacrifices. And it means you put your alcohol down. It means you put your needle or whatever it is you're using to do drugs, put that down. And it means that you put something on, and that's what he tells us here in this passage. But put on the Lord Jesus and make no provision for the flesh to fulfill the lust thereof. All right, here's what I believe that means. When a person decides they're going to quit a former lifestyle, they don't keep the memorabilia of that lifestyle. They put it away. Why? Because if you have it, you likely are going to use it. If you kept it, you might think you're going to use it. And so put that stuff away from you, get rid of it, get it out of your life. Sometimes in recovery groups, we'll have people like one gentleman says, you know what, I was going to pour all my alcohol out, but I decided to keep that bottle of scotch, hadn't been opened yet, and I'm putting it on my mantle to remind me that I have power over that bottle. And guess how long that lasted? In his case, about 3 weeks. But he was slick. What he did is he would drink the scotch and fill the bottle up with water, diluted, where it looked always looked like it was full. Alcoholic people can be very slick. People who are who drink, they can who are the drunkards, These people are going to have a stash. They will have alcohol somewhere. It'll be stored somewhere because they don't want to run out. I don't know if does Arkansas have blue laws? No alcohol sold on Sunday? Okay, Indiana does too. And what will happen is, as the weekend comes up, people hit the package stores and they stock up because they don't want to run out. Okay, and they'll have it in all kinds of different places. Okay, so we talked about what our response is yesterday as a church. I'm going to get to some more of that. But I want some things that are not on this PowerPoint I want to talk with you about tonight. And that is, how does a person stop the use of these chemicals? The answer is that they've got to first, how. How do you stop? How is how you do it. You have to be honest, open, and willing to make the changes necessary in your life. When I ask people, what are you willing to give up in order to have a sober life? Usually, they'll tell me anything. Whatever it takes. And I ask them, are you sure? Because what that means now, that instead of lying to people, now you got to be honest with them. Be straight with people. Tell us the truth. Now, I'm a firm believer that truth should be a hallmark of every person that's dedicated themselves to Jesus. And I'll tell you why I say that. Jesus said, I am the way, the truth, and the life. There's that word truth. To the degree that we honor and embrace and cherish truth, to that same degree we honor and cherish Jesus. Why? Because He's the truth. Well, who's the liar? Satan is the liar and the father thereof. So people who want to get caught up in lies, and often alcoholics will say, well, I lie even when I don't feel like I have to. I've just got so used to lying that I'll make up whoppers and so forth. Well, you got to be honest. You need to be open. Be straight with people. If you're having a rough time, you need to say it. Honest, open, and then willing to do something different. If we do the same things we always did, we will get what we always got. So you got to do something different. Getting into recovery means that change has to take place. And change doesn't come easily. Change is a hard process. Change doesn't mean we'll always get it right. But let me back up just a second and tell you what's going on with a person. Here's a person decides, okay, I've gone through medical detox, or maybe I didn't really need to go through the detox, but I've quit. And I'm doing okay for month, 2 months. It's like, okay, my thoughts are starting to come back. I'm not as foggy as I used to be. I can remember things that I used to question myself about. So I guess I'm getting better. And along about 90 days, there's a thing that will come into the person's life called post, in some cases, not all cases. But in many cases, there'll be post-acute withdrawal syndrome. Now, a syndrome is a collection of symptoms. And it will show itself this way. The person's just sailing along doing great for maybe 90 days. And then all of a sudden, you wake up and it's like, man, I'm real thick-headed today. I feel like I got a hangover. But I hadn't had anything to drink in 3 months now. What's going on? The body is having this post-acute withdrawal syndrome. And it will make you feel like that you got drunk the night before. It'll cause your brain to function like it did when it was drunk, and it will cause rigid thinking or repetitive kind of thinking or circular thinking, or you'll say something and then you'll lose your thought. That happens when you're sober and don't drink at all, but you'll lose your thought and then you try to get that thought back. Short-term memory is affected, long-term memory is affected during these bouts. people then get angry because, you know, this shouldn't be happening. Sometimes they get dizzy. They lose their balance. They're clumsy. The reflexes are a little slow. Their stress level shoots way up. It is my opinion, in working with these people, this is why people relapse. And when I look at the symptoms that are in post-acute withdrawal, and when people have these symptoms, they know they can go take a drink and take the edge off. And so we go back to that thing that took us there in the first place. In alcohol recovery, what we talk about is a thing. There's a lot of acronyms in this field. We talk about BUD, B-U-D, and essentially that means building up to drink. Usually, unless a person is just caught off guard and drinks, usually the person who is about to relapse is going to show some telltale signs and symptoms that are very parallel to this post-acute withdrawal. And they'll have anger, they'll pick fights, verbal or otherwise. They are on edge, they're stressed out, they're having trouble sleeping. Those symptoms are going to come. And what that should be is a warning sign that we're heading in the wrong direction. We're building up to drink. I'm going to talk to you about how to deal with that. But that should be a warning sign. Also, when we overlay that with another thing that we call HALT, H-A-L-T, we have a series of symptoms that will line up with that. I'm building up to drink, and now I'm hungry, angry, lonely, and tired. H-A-L-T. Hungry, angry, lonely, and tired. And to the degree that I have those things, to that same degree, I am. Those are warning signs that you're about to relapse. You don't have to relapse, but by recognizing the signs, you know when you're in trouble. And you know when you're in trouble, your best thinking will take you back to the bottle. So what you need is someone else to help you with your thinking. If you try to do it by yourself when you're like that, you likely will fail. So you need someone to help you. That means you pick up the phone. That means when someone says, "How are you doing?" you give them a straight answer. "I'm really struggling. You know, I've been thinking about using the last few days. I don't want to do that. And I'm not trying to do that, but it just kind of keeps flooding in on me." Let folks know when you're in trouble. Now, that's where we as Christians come in, because if we're going to be accountability partners or big brothers, big sisters to folks, then as they're telling us, I've got some problems here, we need to be there available to them. And we need to know what the resources in our community are. That doesn't always mean people have to go to treatment. Now, the thing that I know is that people do and can get control of those thoughts that are going wild. And guess what? It takes about 20 minutes. The urge is not sustained for a long time. The intensity of that urge will begin to dissipate in about 20 minutes. That means it's important when someone calls you to talk with them. It's important to go and maybe meet them somewhere when they're in trouble. All right. So how do you help an alcoholic? I wrote this down. To begin with, helping alcoholics means that we need the person to make a commitment to a life change. You and I cannot do that for them. It is their recovery, not ours. I see many people make that mistake of vesting more time in the alcoholic than the alcoholic's vesting in themselves. You can't do their recovery for them. This is something they have to do. What we can do is we can be there to support, to encourage these individuals. But you can't do it for them. So it requires a life change. And that life change means that they are going to need to change the people, places, and things that have supported their addiction. People means, who do you drink with? Who are the folks that encourage you to drink? Whether verbally or some other way, that when you're around them, you want to do that. You need to change those people. And right at first, you don't have the strength to be around those folks. You need to stay away from them. Places may be a picnic, maybe going to a ball game. You know, hot day and a cold beer go together for some people. And so it may be at that ball game, I can't go there right now. You know, I'm not strong enough yet. I don't have the tools in place. And then things. Things might be, you know what, when I eat a hot dog, I want a beer with it. And so it may be that I have to do away with hot dogs for a little while. Each person has their own thing, and they'll need to identify that. But people, places, and things, they need to have that as part of their plan of recovery. And by the way, as we said, no plan is a plan to fail. But recovery is really a spiritual program. And with that, here are some tools that people need to put in place. These will also apply for drug addiction. But one of the first things that any recovery program is going to tell you is that you need a connection with a power higher than yourself. That's how they'll phrase it. And I would just change that to say you need a relationship with God. You need another human being who understands what you're going through that can help walk you through it. So when you are weak, they can be strong with you and for you and support you. So we need that. We also need a network of people. And that usually is defined by meetings. And meetings would be, in the secular world, there'd be AA meetings or some recovery meeting of some sort. In church circles, if a congregation has support groups of some sort for its members, then those would be opportunities that you need to be at those meetings. Even if you don't feel like it, even if you feel bad, you still need to be there. In recovery circles, the recommendation is 90 meetings in 90 days. You mean every day for 3 months? Why? Because it takes that long to establish new patterns of change. So 90 meetings in 90 days. Now, it so happens that AA has always got a meeting somewhere. And so you can find meetings to go to. You may go to a variety of different kinds of meetings. Someone says, well, how do I do that if I'm flying? When you're in an airport, listen carefully to the PA system and see if you don't hear birds of a feather is meeting down in such and such a room. What's that? That's a recovery group for the airline people. But everybody's welcome. Birds of a feather. The legal profession, I don't know what the legal profession calls it, but there's a group just for lawyers that is a recovery group. But there's recovery networks all over the place. And 90 meetings in 90 days. Also, what you need to do is to get your hands on any recovery literature that you can find, good recovery literature. That's usually going to be, you'll find it online. You will find Hazleton is a good place to find a lot of good recovery material. Anything by Hazleton is usually right on target, Hazelden. They've got a lot of material. They've got workbooks. So someone says, well, I don't know enough to have a good conversation with somebody that's in recovery. Get the workbook. Have them fill out the workbook and fill out a couple of pages and process that with you. Okay? Because they need to get stuff from the inside out, and they just need somebody to listen to that. And you'll find words to say, words of encouragement or need for explanation, that can kind of be a guide to get you through some of that. A person in recovery has to reorder their priorities. If the main thing in our life has been the alcohol, then something else has to come first. I would suggest that would be Jesus. And his church. And keeping those priorities in line, what's most important, that is significant for this reason. Whatever you put between you and your recovery, you will lose. Someone says, I can't go to the meeting tonight, or I'm going to take a break from all that, and I'm going to go do this. Guess what? You not only aren't going to be able to do that, you'll lose what recovery you have. Because you cannot, you've got to stay focused on recovery. Prayer and meditation are essential. And that prayer is about relationship with God. Meditation is about dwelling on God's Word. Taking a fearless moral inventory, and that has to do with looking at who I really am, looking at the person in the mirror, and coming to grips with this is who I am, and asking, is this really who I want to be? And so making a plan for change. Also, as we get some sobriety under our belt, we want to look at making amends to people that we have offended. And that's a step of repentance. It's a step that if we've wronged someone, if we have taken from people unjustly. You remember those that said Zacchaeus was one. If I've taken more than I should have, I'll restore it several fold more. That's making amends. And so we look at how can I make this up to people? Not that I'm trying to butter them up, but if I've wronged someone, I need to fix that. That's a repentance and remorse step. And then that would be followed by service work. And here's the importance of service work. Service work means that's payback time. I want to help others that are behind me in this process. And so I want to provide services. I want to help people get to meetings. I want to be there for people when they need to talk to somebody. I want to sponsor somebody myself, if you would. And more importantly, all that's important, but probably one of the most important things is have a plan for how you're going to use your downtime. That's where people mess up. And when you have a plan, it needs to be a plan A, B, C, and D. A plan with a contingency plan with a contingency plan. Tell you how this works. Gentlemen was working a pretty decent recovery program. He and his wife were getting along pretty good, and they had planned to go somewhere on a Saturday to visit some relatives. So they're up and getting ready to go, and the phone rings. And the person says, you know, I'm not going to be able to do that today. So the wife said, okay. And so that was called off. Well, now they got a whole day on their hands. So they're sitting around trying to figure what to do, and another relative called the wife and said, well, how about we go do this today? And so she agrees to go do it. All right, so she's out of the picture. Now he's home alone. You see where I'm going with this? He's home alone. So he decides to sit down and watch a football game in the recliner he used to drink in. And he's sitting there watching that, and somebody knocks at the door, rings the bell. It's the guy from the garage next door. Says, hey, I need somebody to help me hold this while I tighten it down. So he goes over to help him. While he's over there, the guy opens the fridge, pops out a cold one, and hands it to him, for he hadn't hardly heard the click. You know the rest of the story. Where did he go wrong? And the truth of the matter is that at any interval in that, there was a problem. What he needed was a plan B to begin with, and a plan C. That, all right, this is the plan, but if that falls through, we'll do this. If that falls through, we'll do this. Sitting down in the places that remind you of your drinking, watching the football game that always went along with the beer, that was a problem. It set his triggers off. And then going to his neighbor's garage and not having him inform that neighbor that he was in recovery. Issues all along there. All right. There are some groups. As a matter of fact, one of the workbooks that you can get, and I strongly recommend this one, it is a book called 12-Step Christianity. that does follow the 12 steps, but it's 12-step Christianity. And you can work that with different people, and you go over that, and that information is going to be there to process with them. All right. There are four absolutes in recovery, and I'm going to end on this note. There are four absolutes. Back in the days when AA was being formed, there was a movement that was already in existence called the Oxford Movement. And that Oxford Movement was an attempt by religious people to be able to be more honest and straight and open with one another in a setting. Now that group, when they began meeting, and by the way, there'd be some names in there you'd recommend, like Harvey Firestone and J.C. Penney and Bill W. and Dr. Bob and some of those. But that was in Akron, Ohio. But what they adopted is there are four absolutes to this group. These are the four absolutes. Total honesty. No one's in here just kind of scamming the rest of us. Total purity in the way we live. Unselfishness in being willing to listen and help each other. And then love. Honesty, purity, unselfishness, and love. And those were the four pieces of that Oxford Movement, and that actually is the foundation piece for AA. Now, I know a lot of folks don't like AA, and that's fine. But the original AA stuff had Bible verses by each of those 12 steps. And if you want to preach sometime from that, you can go back and you can put those verses back in. All of us have enough knowledge to know what those verses are. So you can do that. I want to suggest to you, in closing, this statement. We drank for happiness and became unhappy, for joy and became miserable, for sociability and became argumentative, for sophistication and we became obnoxious, for friendship and we became enemies, for sleep and yet we could not rest, for strength but we became weak, for relaxation, but we began shaking. For bravery, and we became afraid. For confidence, and became doubtful. To start a conversation, but we slurred our speech. To forget, and we became forever haunted. For freedom, and we became a slave. To escape our problems, and they only multiplied. To cope with life, only to realize we are facing death. The great tragedy of life, Henry David Thoreau said, the great tragedy of life is to come to its end only to realize you never lived. Jesus Christ came to give us life and to give it abundantly. I encourage you, instead of living a life of waste, to live an abundant life through Jesus Christ. To Him be that glory. He will lift you out of that slimy pit. He will allow you to be new, and He'll allow you to be clean. We're going to take a little break here, and then we'll be answering some questions. I think that's the way I'm supposed to do it. By the way, these questions could be from anything we've said so far.
Yeah. I have one, Art. When can we give ourselves permission to give up on someone?
When can we give ourselves permission to give up? It's an interesting question. My mind's going a couple places. Sometimes we're not the person to help that person. That our approach or our experience with them or our background is such that what we are offering for help is just being rebuffed. And so we may not be able to help that person. That's where we say, you know, I've done what I can, I'm not able to help you. Or they may tell us that. But in that process, I think that it would be important for us to try to find someone who can be an influence on them, and basically to job that out to someone else. I personally believe that we shouldn't ever give up on anybody, but this may not be the time they're ready for what I have to offer. Usually there'll be a window of opportunity, and it will come at the point of crisis. Right after that crisis, there'll be a window of opportunity. It'll be a small one, and they'll be willing to listen. So rather than giving up, I wait for and look for that moment of opportunity that is the time that I need to click in with them. But they should always know I'm available. Okay? The prodigal son's father did that. Prodigal son's father didn't chase after his son. He didn't go in the wild country and hunt him up and chase him down and try to drag him back home. Instead, he waited patiently and probably had some rough nights until the boy came back. But here's what the boy never forgot. He knew where home was. And that's what we do with people. You may not want my help right now, but you know that help is available. That door's not shut. But if you choose not to have that right now, then that's your choice.
I have one here. Can you give some practical things that we can do to show compassion to the addict without becoming an enabler?
You guys ask tough questions. All right? Some things that we can do to show compassion. Let's define compassion. Compassion means to feel with, to understand that someone has their sorrows and their woes. Pity is not compassion. Sometimes we'll hear people say, "Oh, I feel so sorry for you. You know, you've been through so much." And we give them our pity. An addict doesn't need your pity. Matter of fact, if you give them your pity, they will milk you on that one. And probably try to manipulate you on that one. An addict needs to know that we are there, we care for them, we love them, but we have boundaries. And those boundaries are kind of set. There's a person in my life that lived in my house, and I had to make the statement, I did make the statement, "You are welcome here, your addiction is not. If you choose to live that lifestyle, then you choose not to live in this house." And she chose to live the lifestyle. And she left. And she went into a far country. But she came back. Because the way of the transgressor is hard. I know that, you know that. But it's hard to draw a line. When someone's got you on the phone and they're saying, "Oh, I'm down here in jail, and you know, there's all these scary people down here, and I'm afraid I'm going to be raped," and you know what? That happens sometimes. But I have addicts that will tell me in groups and tell me to my face, "The best thing that ever happened to me was going to jail." And while we may feel bad about that, our compassion can still be there. "I'm really sorry you're having to go through this, but this is a logical and natural consequence of your actions. And I'm here for you, but I'm not going to soften the blow." To the degree that we soften the blow, to that same degree, we make it easier for them to do the same thing over and over. Until the pain of the addiction is greater than the pleasure of the addiction, that person will stay in their addiction. It's got to stop being fun.